Okay, now, this is the last lecture for the unit. We're finishing up the last of the Unit 1 chapters, which we'll easily be able to do in today's time. We were on slide 8, which I've talked about already, but I haven't completed everything I want to say about this. Let's just quickly review what we have talked about. Remember that the overall skin includes dermis and epidermis. So those are the two major layers, but that the dermis is much thicker than the epidermis. They're totally different kinds of tissue too, right? What is the epidermis? What kind of tissue? It's epithelial tissue, correct? Whereas dermis is what? Yeah, it's mostly connective tissue. Much thicker than the epidermis, though. And the epidermis is superficial to the dermis. We also talked about the fact that the dermis, just as one layer, is subdivided into two layers itself, right? The reticular layer and the papillary layer. Why do we call the superficial layer of the dermis, that is, the papillary layer? What does that actually mean? No? Although that's a good guess because it has that P-I-L, right? Papillary is the adjective of papilla, which is a general word meaning any finger-like projection. There are many papillae in the body, like on the surface of the tongue, as I was saying. That's that roughness of the tongue. Those are papillae. So it's not the only place we find papillae, but we see dermal papillae labeled right here where the epidermis has been removed from the dermis. Looks like that foam material. Each one of those little bumps is a papilla. That's why we call that layer the dermal papilla. The papillary layer. The reticular layer is below that, and that gets its name because reticular means like a network, a web-like arrangement. That refers to a bunch of connective tissue fibers in it because it's mostly connective tissue. The hypodermis is not part of the skin, remember. Hypodermis means below the skin, and it, as far as histology is concerned, what kind of tissue is that? Right, that's adipose tissue, made up of adipocytes, each of which is packed full of fat. The vasculature, the blood vessels, notice, are superficial to the hypodermis. They're deep in the dermis, the major ones at least, the bigger ones, but superficial to the hypodermis. Now, why does that make sense? Well, yeah, that's true. But what I mean is, why is it important for these vessels to be superficial to the hypodermis rather than deeper to the hypodermis? No, actually, kind of the opposite. Because blood carries heat and you want to dump it to the surface, if those blood vessels were down here, the heat would be locked in because fat, adipose tissue, is good thermal insulation, right? It would keep that heat in. You want to be able to deliver it to the outside of the insulation so that it will shed heat if you need it to be. All right? By the way, speaking of the dermal papillae, notice that each papilla features blood capillaries. And so that's important because, same reason that capillaries are important all over the body, they bring blood to cells, right? The capillaries are the smallest blood vessels. And so that's where the living cells receive blood, which they need to stay alive because the blood brings things necessary for the cells and it allows the cells to dump things into the blood to get rid of it. So any living cell of the body is either directly against a capillary or within a few cells from a capillary if it's going to remain alive. Well, the epithelium, which is the epidermis, like all epithelia, is, compared to connective tissue, much more cellular, meaning it's a hell of a lot of cells packed together without a bunch of stuff between them. And along those lines, an epithelium, like the epidermis, does not have blood vessels in it. That means that those cells are going to be farther away from a capillary than other cells are. And only the lower cells, the deeper cells within the epidermis, are the ones that remain alive, because those are the ones that are close enough to the dermal papillae's capillary beds. The farther you get from those blood supply, the more likely it is that those cells will be dead. And that's true of the superficial epidermal cells. The ones you actually touch on your skin are dead cells. So it doesn't matter that those are far away from the blood supply. They don't need blood when they're dead. Now, within the thickness of the dermis, we talked about the erector pili muscle and the fact that that leads to horripilation, or hair standing on end. So you have various hair follicles in the dermis, but also you have various glands and you have various sensory receptors. Now, there are different categories of sensory receptors that respond to different kinds of stimuli, but we're not going to get into the particular different kinds and how they differ from each other. Just realize that most of them are mechanoreceptors. A mechanoreceptor is a specialized structure that receives information about or responds to mechanical deformation, meaning being squashed or being stretched, some way being deformed. And so these are your touch receptors in the skin. And some of them are placed deeper and some of them are placed more superficial. And that's because you have different responses to those, right? To feel something as really being poked, you're going to have to compress the skin quite a bit, which is going to push on the deeper ones. But if you just feel something barely on your skin, you're not causing those deeper ones to fire, right? It's the shallow ones that are taking care of that kind. So most of them are mechanoreceptors, but you also have thermoreceptors and some chemoreceptors as well. Chemoreceptors respond to different chemicals. Thermoreceptors respond to changes in temperature. You know, hotter than your body or cooler than your body, you sense that. And by the way, speaking of sense, sense and sensation are not the same thing. Sense just refers to sensory input. Inputs into the central nervous system, the brain and spinal cord, that's incoming information. That is sensory information. So the brain and spinal cord take in sensory information, they deal with it somehow, and then they put information out. That's called motor output. Well, there's all kinds of sensory information coming into your central nervous system all the time. But only some of it, only a little bit of it, actually leads to sensation. Sensation is very high-level processing of that sensory input. That happens in the brain, and it creates a sensation for you, like a smell, a sight, a feeling of being touched. All of that happens in the brain. That's sensation. Now, your brain makes it seem to you like you're feeling that where it's happening on the body, but it's really that feeling is occurring in your brain. So that's sensation, is high-level processing of sensory input. There's all kinds of other sensory input, though, that does not lead to sensation. For instance, your brain is also continuously getting information about your blood pressure and about your heart rate. Things that you just you don't have sensation of that at all, right? That's just all behind the scenes, thankfully. You don't have to worry about all that stuff. So that's the difference between sense and sensation. But all of these sensory receptors provide sensory input to the brain and spinal cord. Now, glands come in a few different varieties that we'll talk about. What we see on this picture, in this coiled arrangement, leading to a duct that empties onto the skin, to the surface of the epidermis, is a kind of sweat gland. Now, there are really two major kinds of sweat glands in the body. The vast majority of them, which are ones that occur all over the skin, are eccrine sweat glands. Some books will use the word mirocrine sweat glands. Those are the same thing, actually. Mirocrine sweat glands or eccrine sweat glands produce what you know as sweat. Sweat is a mostly watery, but also has salt and some other solutes in it, solution that gets delivered to the surface of the epidermis. Why does it get delivered to the surface of the epidermis? Yeah, so that it will evaporate from that surface, and that's what cools you. So it's important in thermoregulation. And that's, like I said, in humans at least, that's happening all over the skin. In other mammals, there are certain parts of the skin that have these sweat glands and some that don't. We're pretty sweaty mammals, though, which saves our lives living here, because without that sweat, we would quickly die of overheating. Anyway, that's one category. There's another category of sweat glands called apocrine sweat glands. And even though they're sweat glands, they don't produce really sweat. They produce a different solution. The apocrine sweat glands produce a solution that is odorless, but does not stay odorless. When it's produced, it doesn't have any odor. Once it's produced, though, just keep in mind that your cells of your body are vastly outnumbered by bacteria, right? For every one of your cells, there's 10 to 100 bacteria living in and on you. So when this odorless substance gets created by these apocrine sweat glands, the bacteria eat it, basically. They break it down, and that turns it into something that has an odor. That's responsible for body odor. And so those are not distributed all over the skin. Otherwise, you would have to apply antiperspirant all over your skin. Those are concentrated in the axillae, which is the plural of axilla, remember? Which is the real name for the armpits. That's the singular. Axillae is the plural. And apocrine sweat glands also occur, let me get a word that works better, in the perineum, which is the region between the genitalia and the anus. So between vagina and anus in a female, and between scrotum and an anus and the anus in a male. These regions feature more hair than most of the skin, and that hair actually enhances the ability, it keeps this substance hanging around longer, gives the bacteria a longer chance to break it down into the substance that actually does have the odor. And that's, evolutionarily, that's been important, because it's been the odor has been a signal to other individuals. Those are technically sweat glands as well, even though it's a totally different purpose. It's not for cooling us off. Those aren't the only glands, though, in the skin. There are also, for instance, what are called ceruminous glands. Now, that's an adjective for cerumen, which is the name for the stuff that gets produced by the ceruminous glands. Cerumen is the anatomical name for earwax. So you have ceruminous glands in the skin of the ear canal. And there are also sebaceous glands. That's an adjective of sebum. The stuff that's produced by the sebaceous glands. Sebum is body oil. So you can see a sebaceous gland right here in this picture. And just like in this picture, most sebaceous glands are associated with a hair follicle. So that as the oil that the sebaceous glands produce, that sebum, as it gets produced, it gets delivered onto the surface of the hair that is continuously growing out toward the skin. And that'll keep the hair oiled, and it will drag the oil onto the surface of the skin, oiling the skin as well. That's enough glands for you to know about. Is there anything else I wanted to say about this? I don't think so. Let's go ahead and go on to 9. Now in 9, we're much closer up. We can just barely see a little bit of the dermis, just a little bit of the thickness of the papillary layer. The reticular layer would be much thicker, going deeper than the floor of this room. So we're really close up. These are individual cells of the epidermis. Remember, though, that the epidermis, even though it is much thinner than the overall dermis, the epidermis itself is multi-layered. So we've already said that the epidermis, histologically speaking, is epithelium, right? And you should know, because we've talked about this, that for any given epithelium, there's two different ways to classify them, right? What are the bases on which we classify epithelia? Well, don't give me examples. What I want is to know what are the two criteria that you used. One basis of classification of epithelium is how many layers there are, right? So on the basis of how many layers there are of cells. And so the two possibilities are simple and stratified, right? Clearly, epidermis is a stratified epithelium. But there's a totally different way of classifying them as well, right? So your first question, if you're confronted with an epithelium and you want to classify it, is does this epithelium have more than one layer? Yes or no? If yes, then it's stratified. If no, then it's simple. Well, the answer here is yes, so it's stratified. Then the next question is, based on a different criterion of classification, what's that other way that we classify them? Based on what?
The shape.
Based on the shape of what?
The cell.
Based on the shape of what cell?
The top layers. The top layer or the top of that layer?
So, top meaning if I were looking at the skin of the sole of my foot, that would be the deepest layer?
No, the superficial layer.
Yes, but there's even a better word than superficial when we're talking about an epithelium. Any given epithelium has polarity, right? Two different directions. What are those words? What is the deepest layer called? Basal layer. And the most superficial layer? Apical layer. So the better word there is that you classify an epithelium based on cell shape by looking at the shape of the cells only in the apical layer, not caring what the shape is for any other layer. It's deeper than that. So in this cartoon, the apical layer is at the top of the figure, right? But for any given epithelium, how do you know that you're looking at the apical layer? What is different about that compared to the other layers of cells, if there are any?
The apical layer is together.
Not necessarily. What did you say?
Unattached surface.
Right, it is unattached. It's the so-called free surface the apical layer is. So that's where you'll see space if you're looking at a microscopic slide of an epithelium. The last layer before there is space of some sort is the apical layer. Now that space can be the outside of the body, like it is for skin, for epidermis. But you'll also see space if you look at the epithelial tissue lining the gut, right? Because the space will be the lumen or the hollow interior of that gut. It's still the unattached surface. The basal surface, on the other hand, is the layer of cells that are directly connected to the what's called the basement membrane, not really shown in this cartoon, but any epithelium has a basement membrane on which it's built. Okay? So, epidermis is not only an epithelium, more specifically, it's a stratified epithelium, and even more specifically, it's a stratified what? Epithelium. Stratified just classifies it on the basis of number of layers. How do you classify it on the basis of cell shape in the apical layer? These pauses are hard to listen to on the recordings.
Squamous?
Squamous, yes, because the apical layer cells, as you see in this cartoon, are much thinner than they are wide. So it's a stratified squamous epithelium. Okay? Now, thin as it is compared to the dermis, there's a lot of layers in the epidermis. The dermis had two major layers, right? Papillary and reticular. They are thick layers, though. The epidermis has more layers, even though it's thinner than the dermis. And those layers are called strata, the plural of stratum. Well, stratum is just another word for layer, so it's kind of a word game. But there are four major strata in all epidermis. And we'll go through these in the picture from bottom to top, but that means from deeper to more superficial. No matter how the picture is drawn, that would be deeper to more superficial. And the reason I want to mention them in that order is because that's the order in which cells move through these strata. So you shouldn't think of the epidermis as being built and then permanent. You know, I kind of compared it to a brick wall before, right? The bricks and mortar analogy. Well, that analogy doesn't hold up to a real brick wall in terms of the bricks staying in place forever, right? The bricks are the cells of the epidermis. They are continuously moving. They're migrating from deeper to more superficial because you're continuously abrading or rubbing off cells from the apical layer. You lose billions of skin cells every day. You know, just by living, just by getting dressed, just the wind blowing on you is going to remove skin cells from you. Well, those have to be replaced, otherwise you'll run out of skin, right? So you have to also build billions of new ones every day, and those are built from the base, from the basement membrane, the basal surface. And then as they mature, they go from one stratum to the next. So that's why we'll mention these from deeper layer to more superficial layer. The deepest stratum is called the stratum basally, a word that refers to the fact that it's at the basal surface. But that's how it's pronounced, basally. And notice that the stratum basally has cells that are more or less cuboidal. But remember, we don't care about the fact that they're cuboidal when we classify the epidermis on the basis of cell shape, because when it's a stratified epithelium, the only shape that matters is the cells, the shape of the cells that are in the apical layer, not the basal layer. So there are a couple major kinds of skin cells or epidermal cells in the stratum basally. Most of them, by far most of them, are keratinocytes, which is one way you can pronounce that. Literally a keratin cell, right? Because they produce a lot of keratin, which is strong protein. You can also pronounce that as keratinocyte. Either one is acceptable. But a keratinocyte is the main type of epidermal cell. And you can see on the bottom, on the stratum basally layer here, that many of them have this kind of shape right here. That's referring to mitosis. You remember briefly talking about mitosis? We didn't spend much time on it in the chapter. But what is mitosis? Do you remember? Mitosis is part of cell division. Mitosis is division of the nucleus. And the other part of cell division is cytokinesis, which is division of the rest of the cell, everything outside of the nucleus. When they both happen, then one cell splits into two cells. So that's overall cell division. This is happening frequently in the cells of the stratum basally. And this explains what I was talking about before. You have to replace cells that are continuously being lost at the other surface, the apical surface, so they continuously need to be created, new cells, at the basal surface. Well, cells don't just pop into existence, right? Cells come from pre-existing cells. So you get new cells when one cell that already is living splits into two new cells. And notice, by the way, that that's different from, for instance, a pregnant woman giving birth to a child. Because nowadays, at least, when things go correctly, she usually survives that process, right? The mother still exists. Well, when a cell reproduces, it splits into two new cells, the original cell is no longer there. It's gone, right? It is now two new cells. And so, if both of the cells that one of these stratum basally cells splits into, if both of those start migrating through these strata, then you would run out of stratum basally cells, right? Because that original cell is no longer there. So when these cells undergo cell division, turns it into two cells, one of them will then mature and go through the other strata, and the other one will stay around and replace the one that was lost when it split into two. So you always have this population of cells in the stratum basally. Does that make sense? So those are keratinocytes, and we'll talk more about the importance of keratin as we get through the strata. But let me tell you that there's also, like you see in gray in the cartoon, a different class of epidermal cells called melanocytes, named for the fact that they are melanin-producing cells. We talked about melanin already, right? That's a pigment molecule. So melanocytes are cells that produce these pigment molecules, and the pigment molecules are what's responsible for the lightness or the darkness of human skin. But why do we have these melanin molecules? Not just so that we look light or dark. The real purpose is what?
Protect us from the harmful light.
Exactly. Pigments in general in chemistry are substances that absorb light. And so melanin is a pigment responsible for absorbing ultraviolet light from sunlight, which is what can damage the DNA. I think I mentioned this before, but the melanin granules don't just evenly disperse throughout the cell. Instead, you have a skin cell with a nucleus. That's where the DNA is. The melanin collects just on one side of the nucleus, the sunny side of the nucleus, like a little parasol protecting just that DNA. But it's not... The melanin is produced only by these melanocytes, which are the minority of these cells. Most of them are keratinocytes. But the melanin produced by the melanocytes doesn't stay in the melanocytes. The melanin gets transferred to the keratinocytes by an interesting mechanism, actually. You can barely see it here, but these melanocytes in gray are not just compact cells. They have long extensions of themselves. This is still part of the same cell. And as these melanin molecules are produced in little packets, those packets are put into these long arms that extend from the cell. And then the neighboring keratinocytes in the area, you can't see this on this cartoon, but what these neighboring keratinocytes do is phagocytize these long arms of the melanocytes. Do you remember what phagocytosis is? To phagocytize just means to undergo phagocytosis. But what is phagocytosis? Right, it means cell eating. So it's a type of vesicular transport, right? Bringing something into the cell by surrounding it and forming a vesicle. That's what the keratinocytes are doing. They're basically taking little nibbles of these arm-like extensions from the melanocytes containing melanin granules, and that puts those melanin granules inside the keratinocytes. They don't produce it on by themselves, but they need it. And then once they're in the keratinocytes, you can see the specks right here, then they start to cluster over just the nucleus to protect the DNA from UV damage. Now, the next more superficial stratum after stratum basale is stratum spinosum. That gets its name because when you prepare a slide of epidermis for microscopy, remember, when you prepare slides, you have to stain them and do all kinds of things so the things will show up. Well, that affects the cells. So the cells in this layer shrink when you prepare them for a slide, but they're connected to each other by desmosomes. Remember, we talked about desmosomes being little spot welds? So when they shrink away from each other but are held still by these spot welds, it makes them look spiny. It makes them look like they have a bunch of spines coming off of them, like cacti. Well, they don't really look like that in a living skin, but that's why they're called that, stratum spinosum, because of how they look under prepared microscope slides. The important thing about the stratum spinosum is that it contains several layers of cells, most of which are these keratinocytes that are busy producing a bunch of keratin fibers, very strong proteins. Because these cells, as they are maturing and migrating away from the stratum basale and toward the apical surface, they are becoming tougher and tougher cells, making a better and better barrier, which is appropriate for epidermis, right? It has a barrier function. Okay, then the next layer is the stratum granulosum. Now, this name comes from the fact that by this time, by the time the cells get to this layer, remember, it's the cells spend some time in each stratum. They're just migrating and maturing and developing as they go. But when they get to the stratum granulosum, they're called that. Stratum is called that because they are now busy producing granules. And exporting those granules, exuding them from their surface, these granules contain mature or finalized forms of keratin, which is particularly tough compared to the so-called pre-keratin that was made earlier. Actually, what's happening is the granules contain other proteins that are necessary to lock the keratins together to make the network very strong. Okay, so that's what the granules responsible for the granulosum name are doing. But another thing that's important is happening in the stratum granulosum, and the cells are producing what are called lamellar bodies. Now, they're little flat products, and lamella is yet another word that means layer. Something that is laminated has a layer on it, a lamella. But anyway, lamellar bodies are also produced. Granular bodies and lamellar bodies are produced by these cells. The lamellar bodies, though, are rich in lipid. And lipid is what waterproofs the cell. So when I use the analogy of the bricks and mortar, the cells are becoming tougher and tougher because of the keratin, and they're forming the bricks. But because they are exporting lipids from their interior, that's producing the waterproof mortar between the bricks and making the skin more waterproof. Now, cells all through these first three strata are still alive, but not for long. Because notice they're getting farther and farther away from the blood supply that's down in the dermis, as I was talking about earlier. So the final stratum is the stratum corneum. Corn and horn both really mean the same thing in anatomy. They refer to hardened things, like a horn of a rhinoceros, for instance. Or a corn on your foot is a hard place. So cornified cells means cells that have become especially hardened. And that's why even though these are still keratinocytes, it's still the same cells just later on, we now rename them, once they're in this outer stratum, into corneocytes. Horny cells is what that really means, hard cells. And so the stratum corneum has not only hardened cells, but they've died now, or they're dying as they transition from stratum granulosum to stratum corneum. And notice that they drastically flatten out. When they die, they become especially hard and flat, and they're waterproof because of those lipids that have been produced between them. And notice there's a lot of layers of cells just within the stratum corneum. So overall, it's a stratified epithelium, but the stratum corneum, which is just one stratum of the epidermis, is itself highly stratified, many layers of cells within that. And that's where you're continuously losing them from, the apical layer. Now, all skin of the body has these four strata. There's a couple places in the body, though, where there's, in addition to these four strata, there's one more stratum. And that's the difference between what we call thin skin and thick skin. Thin skin is almost everywhere that there's skin. Thick skin is found in the soles of the feet and the palms of the hand. And obviously it's named that because it's thicker. Well, it's thicker for two reasons. One is that it has an additional stratum. It has these four, plus it has one called the stratum lucidum. Lucid means clear. Right? Whether someone's speaking lucidly, meaning you can understand him because he's clear, but it also means transparent, and that's how it looks under microscopes. That's why they're called that. Anyway, the stratum lucidum is between stratum granulosum and stratum corneum, only in thick skin. So thick skin is thicker for that reason alone. That's one reason it's thicker. But also it's thicker because each of the individual strata, compared to thin skin, has more cell layers in it. So it's doubly thick compared to thin skin. And it makes sense, right? Those are the parts of the body that undergo the most abuse, especially over evolutionary time, where you're wielding clubs or walking around barefoot and stuff like that. You really abuse the skin in those parts, so it needs to be thicker. All right, I just want to mention, since they're pictured, this Merkel cell down here, that's just a part of a sensory receptor. This is one of those pretty superficially placed ones. You have a bunch of receptors that are much deeper in the dermis, but these superficially placed ones are really sensitive to just barely being touched because it doesn't take much to deform them since they're near the surface. And the blue thing here, labeled as a dendritic cell, dendro means tree. So dendritic means branched like a tree, looking like a tree. Dendritic cells are found here and there throughout the skin, but they're moving around continuously. They are really part of your immunity. They're important for your immunity. So dendritic cells continuously surveil the skin, looking for things that are foreigners. And when they find them, they engulf them, not so much to protect you directly by engulfing them, but when they engulf them, they then present part of that the molecular structure of that foreign material to the surface of their cell so that white blood cells can recognize that. And so they basically send a signal to the white blood cells that there is this foreign material in your body, and then the white blood cells deal with producing antibodies to hopefully protect you against that. All right. Now we can go on to 10. This is just a photomicrograph, and hopefully you already recognize this since you've been looking at these slides so long. Hopefully you recognize this as skin. The reason that you should recognize this as skin is because the appearance of the dermis is pretty distinctive, right, as connective tissue. And you also see that connected to that is clearly an epithelium with all these cells, right? Not only because of all the cells, but you should recognize that this is an epithelium because it has a free space, an empty space that it's where there's nothing attached, right? The free surface is the apical surface. So this is most likely skin, you should reason, because you have connective tissue in the dermis and then epithelial tissue in the epidermis, and clearly it is highly stratified. You also see that the papillary layer features these dermal papillae, these little bumps that go up and down as you go across the surface. But it's just a picture that you should be well aware of by now. No new information, really, for that. Slide 11, though, something we haven't really talked about much. This is obviously a cartoon version of just part of the shaft of a hair. This would be the part of the hair that is visible to you. Now, the visible part is not the entire hair, of course, because it starts out in the follicle, which is down in the dermis. You don't even see the dermis, right? Because it's deeper than the epidermis. But we saw hair follicles in the cutaway view of the skin that we looked at earlier. What you see in this cartoon version, though, is all along the length of the shaft of a hair, no matter where you cut into it as a cross-section like you see here, you can notice that it is layered. It really has the appearance of three concentric cylinders sharing a common center, that is. And the deepest of these layers, notice, is labeled medulla. And then superficial to that is cortex. Well, these are really general terms as well. We reuse these terms for many different parts of the body. So these aren't specific to just hair. Any kind of organ or structure that clearly has a layered appearance to it, like a good example would be the kidneys. Not from just the exterior view, but if you cut through a kidney, you'll see that the deeper part is much different in structure compared to the superficial part. And when that's true, we usually use the words cortex and medulla to refer to the different parts of that structure, whatever it is, including hairs. Cortex always means the more superficial part, and medulla always means the deeper part. This, by the brain, is another example. The cerebrum, the major part of the brain, is another good example of this. The surface of that is the cerebral cortex. The medulla is deeper. Similarly with the spinal cord. You have a cortex and a medulla. Medulla is always deeper. So that's the yellow part in this cartoon. By the way, each species has its own relative thicknesses of these, of the cortex and medulla of the hairs, which is a major way that you can forensically identify whether a hair, for instance, at a crime scene or whatever, is human hair or some other sort of animal. That's not the only two layers in hair, though. Notice that there is the most superficial, even more superficial than cortex, which is already means more superficial, is the cuticle. Cuticle, by the way, comes from a word cutis, which is yet another word for skin. But obviously it's not skin as we know it anatomically. Skin, just in the general sense, means covering, right? And specifically, cutis is a hardened skin, a hardened covering. And ickel, that's just a diminutive suffix. Whenever you have that in a word, it means small version of whatever the root is. So it means a small hardened skin cuticle, and that's another general word. Hairs are not the only thing that have cuticles. Anything that's hardened can be called that. So that's those are the three layers. You don't see much detail really in this cartoon version. If we look at slide 12, though, we can. This is a real photograph, a photomicrograph. Now you wouldn't come close to seeing this much detail on the light microscopes that you've been using, but this is if you get an electron microscope that can magnify many, many times more, then you can see this detail. And the main thing that is important to look at here is the cuticle itself, this outer surface. By the way, this is growing down and to the left because where it's this is the skin that it's coming out of. Okay. But notice the appearance of the cuticle. It's not a smooth appearance like that cartoon in the previous slide. This looks like overlapping shingles, right? And look at the direction in which they're overlapping. If the hair is growing upward, it's not in this picture, but just imagine one growing upward from the skin. The overlapping is like this, not like this. So, why do you suppose it would be that way? Why have this overlapping structure? Any ideas?
It's like the same thing when you're in the house, like how the shingles are like, the roof is like in a certain way so the water doesn't get in and it just falls off.
Well, that is definitely why a roof is that way. But that's not exactly what's going on here. These are like little barbs, right? If they were reversed, pointed, you know, overlapping in the other direction, then it would be really easy to slide this thing out, right? Or if it were just smooth and not overlapping at all, it would be easy to pull it out. But since they're arranged this way, you try to drag this out of the follicle, and these are going to stick, right? These are like little hose barbs, which is, you know what I mean by hose barbs? On a piece of pipe, you'll have hose barbs so that you can stick a piece of rubber tubing on it, and it will stay in place. So the cuticle has this overlapping structure to keep it in place. Now, of course, there's a limit. If you really try, you can pull a hair out of its follicle. But if it didn't have this overlapping arrangement, it would fall out much more easily. So it keeps it in place. By the way, hair is obviously much tougher than skin. I've already told you that skin is tough. Those corneocytes that make up the stratum corneum are very toughened cells compared to normal cells. Well, they're tough because of keratin, as I said. But there are two major categories of keratin in the body called soft keratin and hard keratin. And the keratin that's in skin cells is soft keratin, tough stuff, but not nearly as tough as hard keratin, which is found in hair and nails, both of which are much tougher than regular epidermal skin cells. And in slide 13, we can see a cartoon version of this follicle of hair. So this is deep in the dermis, right? This is hypodermis below it. You don't really see the detail of the dermis, but it would be on either side of it. This hair follicle, if you look at it in cross-section as we are, features a papilla of its own, just like the dermal papillae that jut up next to the epidermis. Each hair follicle features its own papilla, a hair papilla. Same use of the word for the same reason, a little finger-like projection. But importantly, that papilla features a rich blood supply. It's a capillary in there, bringing blood to the nearby cells so that they can remain alive. So this pretty much the same thing that's happened in epidermis is happening in the hair as well, except in a little bit different orientation. cells are actively dividing, creating new cells right here by this papilla. And as they are produced, that pushes everything else upward, creating a longer and longer hair. And as it approaches the epidermis, those cells will eventually get too far away from the blood supply and die and harden, but harden even much more than skin cells. So by the time you see them coming out of your epidermis, those are already dead. Right? This is why it doesn't hurt to get your hair cut. There's no nerve supply. Those cells are long dead. You're just cutting them off. The living stuff is down in the dermis, in the follicle. Brings us to 14. Nails, even harder than hair, because they have, not only do they also have hard keratin as opposed to the skin's soft keratin, but they have much more of it than the hairs do. So they're the toughest of the three major things the skin is made up of structurally. The cutaneous, the integumentary system, I should say, not skin. Skin, hair, and nails are the three major structures of the integumentary system, and nails are the toughest by far. I'm sure you knew that already, just from experience, and you probably familiar with the basic anatomy of a nail. Now, a finger is shown here, but all of these words also apply to any toenail. They're all really the same, except in shape and thickness. What you actually cut, if you cut your nails, is the free edge. The free edge is just the part that is not any longer in direct contact with skin. But the main length of the nail, as you go from proximal to distal, the main length of that nail is in contact with skin, just deep to it. But it's not in contact like the epidermis is in contact with the dermis, basically staying put. The skin is kind of staying put, and the skin, which is called the nail bed, that's just the skin in that area, but it's continuous with the rest of the skin, right? Just part of the skin. The skin is staying put, but the nail is continuously dragging against that skin because the nail is continuously moving, right? Just like a hair is continuously moving as it grows outward, so is the nail. Now, just like a hair, the entire visible part of the nail is already dead. And that's why it's so hard. The living part is deep under this fold of skin right here. And it's being produced continuously by new cells being added from what's called the nail matrix. So the nail matrix is where the cell division is taking place. That's adding nail cells continuously. And then they will be pushed distally, moving the whole nail distally, but they will harden and die before they start appearing because all of this stuff is under this fold of skin, right? And so by the time they emerge to be visible, they're well hardened and dead, and that occurs right where the cuticle is. The cuticle is not really part of the nail. The cuticle, another use of the same word I was talking about, is that hardened piece of skin right next to where the white part of the nail is. And that white part of the nail, by the way, is called lunule. Why is it called that? Right, it looks like it means little moon. ULE is another diminutive suffix, and luna means moon. So lunule means little moon, just because of their shape. So that's right after the cuticle. That's already dead, and it'll just continue to move distally, and you snip it off at the free edge. Now, nails are hard for good reason, right? They've been important tools. Still are. We use fingernails for a lot of things. Not so much digging in the earth like earlier humans did, much more than we do, but nails are tough. They're not only important in us, but in all kinds of different animals, right? Important components of the overall integumentary system. So that is the chapter. And obviously we have some time left, so I'm not saying we have to use every minute, but since we have some time, Let me just ask you whether you have anything you want to go over or any questions about before the Wednesday's test from these four chapters. Anything that you're curious about or that you want me to clarify? Yeah.
So on the summary sheet?
Yes. Yeah, actually, yeah, you reminded me to say this. Sorry to cut you off, but I wanted to say this anyway. Sorry I didn't notice this, because I didn't invent the summary sheet. I didn't make that template, and so I didn't notice it because they dropped this 160 on me at the last minute. I didn't realize I was going to teach this. But anyway, yes, you're right. The labels on the summary sheet are incorrect as far as the units are concerned, right? Each page is supposed to be a unit. And the first page includes not the entire unit. Skin, which is chapter 4, is on page 2, which is unit 2, supposedly. Well, if you, hopefully this is not the case, but if you haven't even started it yet, then it's fine to just make the boxes on the front page, you can label those boxes as the names of the first four chapters. That's one way you can do it. If you've already done it and you've filled them out as labeled on the template, that's also fine, but you can add skin information from chapter 4 to the skin box on page 2, and you can just use both pages for the test. Okay, and I'll just grade it as unit 1. You see what I'm saying there? Does everyone understand? Now, does that answer your question also?
Yeah, I was going to ask if she was going to be a part
of it. Yeah, well, apparently the instructor that did that might have included this chapter in the second unit. I don't know why she did it, to tell you the truth, but it's in unit 1 for us. So it's chapter 4 will definitely be on the test, and you should include it in your summary sheet, but you can do it either of two ways that I just mentioned. By the way, to get full credit for that, otherwise though, other than the errors that we just talked about in the template, just make sure you do include everything that is in the document that describes what should be in the summary sheet, because I use that rubric to grade you. Any questions about the material? Well, it can be about anything. You can ask me about the test as well, but I mean, remember, oh, did everyone remember to get a Scantron? Or several Scantrons, because you'll need several. Remember that I won't have any because they don't give us some anymore. So if you forget the Scantron, you're going to have to beg from one of your classmates. Also, keep in mind, I've already talked about the test formats, but remember the test is entirely multiple choice. It's 50 questions exactly, and each of them has four choices, A, B, C, and D. So those are the answers, A, B, C, and D. You just need to figure out the order. We'll take the whole 75 minutes to do it. Now, it might not take you that whole time, but we're not doing anything else for the lecture part, just the test. You can't leave, though, permanently, because we have to do lab, by the way. And speaking of that, just because we have a test does not mean it's not Wednesday. You still should expect a quiz on the laboratory component. And that reminded me temporarily of something. What was it? Oh, yeah, people are kind of in a different state of mind on test days, so don't forget to sign in as usual. You'll come in here. Actually, this reminds me of still something else. Right now, make sure that you have in your manual your name printed on the front page, at the top, the very first page, the title page or whatever it is. Because you're going to hand these in as well. So the other thing I wanted to make sure is that you're going to be up to date on everything, score-wise. So obviously Wednesday the big deal is the test, but that's not the only thing. You need to have your summary sheet done for Unit 1 on Wednesday. Because you're going to use it during the test, right? So don't give me the summary sheet. Don't hand that in as you come in. Keep that for the test. But do hand in the manual And keep in mind, let's look at the table of contents. Don't forget about the study activities, which are really lecture-based, right, rather than lab-based. These are things I talked about on the first day, and I said you can do on your own time, but those become due on test days. So you need to have all of the Unit 1 study activities on in the table of contents. That needs to all be filled out. Okay? Keep them in your book. Don't tear them out. That's why you're handing the whole manual in, and that's why you need to have your name in the manual. In addition to the study activities, though, you need to have all the laboratory activities done by then, filled out. So that includes the first three, human body, anatomical terms, and tissues. But just keep in mind that tissues is not just the part in the manual that starts on 65, goes all the way up to 76. It also includes the handout I gave you. So, as you come in, you're signing in, and you're handing in the manual, which will have all three study activities done for Unit 1 and all three laboratory activities, including the handout, which should be in your manual as well. Is that all clear? Then you'll enjoy the test, then you'll enjoy the quiz, and then you'll enjoy the dissection that we do after the quiz. So that's what we're in for on Thursday. Any questions before I stop the recording? You have anything else you want to ask about?
What's the dissection for Thursday?
Well, you should know that because it's on the syllabus, but I'm happy to tell you. But I'm just trying to goad people into remembering to keep looking at the syllabus. It's a useful document. The dissection we do is chicken.
That's cool.
Anything else? Yeah. No. Oh, yes, there's one thing you do need to do to prepare for the dissection. Listen, on dissection days, you have to have closed-toed shoes. Now, it's still cold enough that people do anyway, but you can't stay if you don't have closed-toed shoes, so you'll lose a lot of credit for that. Make sure you at least bring them if you don't wear them. Yeah.
How should we study and practice?
Well, you can't really. I mean, I don't want to say leave it until the very last minute, but it's far enough off that you don't really have to be worrying about it right now. Except what you should be doing continuously is completing these lab activities well enough, not only so you get credit for each lab activity, but so that you have a good source of information to study. That's why you're not tearing the lab manual sheets out. You're keeping them in there and completing them well enough so that you can consider this to be a good thing to study for the practicum. Okay? So the main thing, you know, and I'll talk more about the practicum as we get closer to it on how it's arranged and things like that. But the main thing is that now that today we're going to be finishing finally this tissues thing. You're going to look at them a final time and finalize things today. That doesn't mean you can forget about tissues. You still need to know about everything you did in the lab for the practicum. So take some time to, when you fill these out, don't just race through it. Make it a good resource to study for the practicum with. Anything else? Yeah? The first three. The first three labs, and also the first three study activities, I think they're called. That's just study activities. The labs are 57 through 76. Plus the handout. Yes. Is that all? Go ahead. There's no limit.
Are you grading this more on completion, or are you going to go through each answer?
Well, a little bit of each. Okay. It depends on which section we're talking about. And that's why you already got credit for some of them. That was just for completion, obviously. Because I didn't look at your individual manuals that day. Anything else? Okay.